Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Falsko, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council. Sounds like there's a little bit of a musical buzz going on. Okay. I'd like to welcome everyone here today on this Friday afternoon for a program that we are very, very excited about. If you wouldn't mind turning off your cell phones, today's program will be recorded for KSKA. I'd like to thank William Toyer for doing the recording. It will be available. You can go to the alaskapublic.org's website, or you can come to ours and we'll link you right over there if you want to hear this program or any of our past programs. We are a membership organization, and our fiscal year starts next week, so your memberships will be expiring, so please beat the rush and consider renewing a couple days early and supporting our great programs. We're going to start a whole bunch of fun things next year, so please stay tuned for some of the familiar and some new things coming your way. We'll have it up on our website, and we'll send you some emails to let you know what's going on. You can also join us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. We are posting all sorts of things on our Facebook page. So like us and join us and tell us what you think about this program and some of our upcoming programs. If you're a student, could you please stand? Do we have any students during this spring break? Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you so much to BP for sponsoring our student programs. And I'd like to recognize one of the students I saw in the audience, one of our former high school gifted interns. We're part of the School Business Partnership Program, where we will host a gifted high school student for a semester. And I see Kale Klingenpiel, who is in Washington, D.C. and going to Georgetown. Hi, Kale, if you could just wave. Welcome back. It's great to see you. We're excited to see all the things he'll be doing. And we also, I'd like to recognize some people from our consular corps I see here in the front. We have Miss Diddy Hitchens and Miss Natalie Novak. Thank you so much for coming. And at this time, I would like to introduce our head table. To my far left, I have Mr. Greg Wolf, who is a former board member of the Alaska World Affairs Council and the director of the World Trade Center Alaska, a partner in this program. And we are thrilled to partner with them on so many different programs and have him here today. Thank you, Greg. And to his right, Mr. Garrett Wong, who'd like to bring to the podium our outgoing chairman of our board. He will be introducing our speaker, Mr. Garrett Wong.
Lisa, thank you. Ah, what a ring. Near past chairman of the board. Before I introduce the ambassador this afternoon, I wanted to call up some of my retiring board members from this year's board who have served the organization very well over many years. And we have a certificate of appreciation. So I'm going to call all my board members up that are retiring from the board, and we can save our applause until we get through all. So I'd like to ask Nancy Eliason to come on up. Renee Stewart, please come on up. And Liz Carter, if you're here. These board members have done an extraordinary job of making the Alaska World Affairs Council just run so terrifically. So ladies, thank you for your great service. A round of applause for our retiring board members. You guys are And so we're going to let you take these.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now we'll get to the good stuff in introducing our speaker today. It is my pleasure to introduce the Singapore Ambassador to the United States, Mr. Asok Kumar Mupuri. Mr. Mupuri took up his appointment as Singapore's ambassador to the United States in July of 2012. Prior to his current appointment, he served as the ambassador to Indonesia between 2006 and 2012. And before that, he was the High Commissioner to Malaysia from 2002 to 2006, and then the High Commissioner to Australia between 2000 and 2002. A career diplomat, Mr. Mupuri, joined the Ministry of Foreign Affairs back in 1984. In 1994, he was appointed Director of Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Policy Planning and Analysis Directorate for Southeast Asia. Back in 1997, Mr. Mapudi assisted Shell International Limited in the United Kingdom as a corporate advisor on Asia-Pacific affairs. He received Mr. Mapudi graduated with honors degree from the National University of Singapore. He's received his MA at the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies under a Raffles Scholarship. He also attended the program for executive development at the Institute for Management and Development in Switzerland and the Advanced Management Program at Harvard University Business School here in the U.S. Mr. Mapudi was awarded the Public Administration Medal by the Singapore government back in 2010. Now, this afternoon, the ambassador is going to speak about Singapore and the United States cooperation in the Asia-Pacific region. So please help me extend a very warm Anchorage welcome to Ambassador Mapudi.
Thank you for that very warm introduction. And there's one thing missing from my biographical note, an oversight which I should correct, because today I'm joined here by my wife, Gauri Mirpuri, who's come with me to Alaska. And she's been very much a part of my diplomatic career as a close supporter and in many ways doing things that parallel my work in her own interests in terms of social entrepreneurship and other things. So, you know, she may want to take some questions later as well, just to sort of put her on the spot. But, you know, it's really an honor for me to be here today, and very far away from Washington, D.C., but also very far away from Singapore. As I read your slogan, bringing the world to Alaska, I had actually titled my presentation, Where Worlds Meet, because Singapore is a place in many ways where worlds come together. And I think that while we are very, very distant apart in terms of weather, you know, you have an Arctic climate, we have a tropical climate, there are differences in size, I think in many ways the strategic location of Alaska parallels the strategic location of Singapore in Southeast Asia. And I wanted to spend a few minutes first speaking and introducing Singapore to you, because not all of you will be very familiar with Singapore, and then speaking on the Singapore relationship with the United States, both bilaterally as the two countries together, as well as regionally in Asia Pacific, because I think some of the Asia Pacific areas will interest Alaskans. And then as well speak on Singapore's recent membership, or we've just become a permanent observer of the Arctic Council, and address why, you know, it's a question that keeps coming up. Why has Singapore suddenly taken this interest in the Arctic? Now, as ambassador to the United States, one of my key roles is to go around and introduce Singapore to many communities. It's well known with the business community and some of the political community, but Singapore is not very well known across the board in the country. Now, we're a country with a history and a geography shaped very much by our size. In terms of our history, Singapore is a maritime trading state that was founded by the British about 200 years ago, essentially to support British trade between Europe and East Asia. And there was no history before that, very small indigenous communities, and Singapore really emerged over these 200 years under the British rule. We suddenly had independence thrust upon us less than 50 years ago. We're a very unlikely country. Our main basis of our economy 50 years ago was a British military base. And when the British decided that they wanted to withdraw from that military base, 20% of our population became unemployed. At the same time, we were having ourselves put in a position where we became an independent country. So it's a very unique history in terms of our ability to survive into the future. because we are a country without any natural resources of our own. We are a country that has to rely on the world for ourselves. In terms of our geography, we are 5 million people in a size about 260 square miles, which someone described to me as a distance between Anchorage and Wasilla. So that's about the size of our 5 million people trying to get crammed into this small area. We rely on water from our neighbors. We buy water from Malaysia. We rely on energy from around the world. We get energy from the United States as well. We've built up a petrochemical hub and an energy trading hub, but without energy resources of our own at all. We have no agriculture, so we have to buy all our food from around the world. And so that's really shaped our thinking. We're very fortunate geographically to be in a very dynamic Asia-Pacific region. And that's also been where our strength has come. We may be a small state without natural resources, but that geographical position has given us the ability to navigate in a larger region that allows us to reach out to the world, to make ourselves strategically important to the world, strategically important to the business community, and strategically important in terms of for our people, where they can do a number of things. Now, Lisa reminded me that she first heard me speak when all the World Affairs Councils met in Washington, D.C. the day after the last presidential election. There was a day-long seminar on national security issues, and I was asked to speak on education. So education was then placed very squarely in the center of national security. And Singapore was invited because with our lack of natural resources, we really had to focus on building up the skills of our people. Education has been so important. We have one of the best K-12 education systems in the world. We have some of the best universities in the world. And that's really where we've had to focus so much of our attention. But what we've had to do is then use this education, use this educated population to reach out to the world to make ourselves relevant. And in particular, we've had to make ourselves very relevant to the business communities. Singapore, as we had independence thrust upon us, really had to rethink our entire development strategy. As I said, 20% of the jobs were based on the British military base, which was leaving, and we very quickly had to industrialize because we had no other resources to do it. So a very early process of industrialization, at a time when the rest of the world was turning away foreign investors, we were inviting foreign investors to come to Singapore. And they were coming in there, bringing new methods of doing things, new manufacturing processes, and we were getting the people ready for them. Today, we've become a developed country based very much on this industrialization strategy that were first oriented towards exports, but now really grown towards services and making ourselves very, very key in terms of global and regional developments. And that's very unique way of approaching what Singapore has. And in many ways, Alaska shaped some of our early processes of as we were emerging as a country. Alaska is now in that period where you have to make certain economic choices as well. How do you move forward? Obviously, your system is so different. You're part of a larger country, the United States of America. You have so many resources, but you will have to make these choices on education in particular and how you build up the people towards that context. Now, the Singapore-US relationship has been very critical to Singapore's development. One of the first countries that recognized Singapore as we became independent in 1965 was the United States of America. And we've had this very long-standing relationship that reaches out. There are three broad areas in terms of our working with the United States: the economic bit of it, the defense bit of it, and a very strong political and diplomatic part of that relationship. In terms of economic relations, as I said, Singapore opened itself up to foreign investment companies to come in. And some of the key companies that came in were actually U.S. companies. Very early on, we had most of the U.S. multinationals who were at that time in the 1960s and 70s looking for industrial bases in the Asia-Pacific. And they reached out to Singapore as a place where they could invest, where they could create jobs for us, but also create production that could then be exported. And we have worked very closely in that. In that context, Singapore was the first Asian country to sign a free trade agreement with the United States of America. About 10 years ago, we completed our U.S.-Singapore Free Trade Agreement, and this was signed to great success, and it's really helped us anchor the U.S. business community in Singapore. Today, there are more U.S. investments in Singapore than there are in China. And it's, in fact, very little known because most people are so focused on the investments in China. It's actually that Singapore takes more U.S. investments. Not all of them stay in Singapore. They use Singapore as a regional base to reach out to the rest of the region. So it's been a very critical part of our development is having this U.S. business community coming in. And we've made ourselves very open and direct in terms of our relationship with U.S. business communities. One of the things that I'm doing over here is actually speaking to the business community in Alaska of how we could do more to partner in the new areas, in new technologies that are starting to emerge, and whether Singapore, with our R&D capability, with our technological capability, can really move forward into what is effectively a new frontier for us, for a tropical country looking at an Arctic region quite differently and dealing with some of these issues. And I will speak on some of those when I speak on Singapore's observership in the Arctic Council. The other area where we have a very close relationship with the United States is our security cooperation. Singapore was one of the first countries to support the U.S. military presence in Southeast Asia. And today, we have a strategic partnership dialogue, strategic framework agreement that actually allows the U.S. military to use our facilities as the Navy and the Air Force comes around the region. Now, this really dates back to the Vietnam War, and many people have different experiences here about the Vietnam War. In Singapore, we actually saw the U.S. commitment to Vietnam as very important for our survival. And a few months ago, on behalf of the Singapore government, I made a contribution to the Vietnam Memorial Fund Education Center to make known the fact that as the U.S. fought the war in Vietnam against communism, it helped the non-communist countries in Southeast Asia, which were all facing communist insurgencies, Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, and Thailand. As we were dealing with communist insurgencies, because the U.S. was fighting in Vietnam, it actually helped us focus on economic development and gave us an opportunity to build our future. So since the 1960s, we've had a very strong relationship with the U.S. and have welcomed the U.S. military commitment to the region. When the Philippines asked the U.S. to leave the bases in Clark and Subic Bay in 1990, Singapore opened itself up, our facilities. We couldn't put a base because, as I said, our geography is way too small to have a military base. But we opened up our facilities for the U.S. Navy and Air Force to be able to come through the region. And that's become a very critical part of our relationship between Singapore and the U.S., the strong defense ties that we have. Now, these economic and defense ties are tied together with a very strong political relationship. My Prime Minister, Lee Hsien Loong, was in Washington, D.C. about 2 months ago, had very detailed discussions with President Barack Obama and a number of the new secretaries, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and Secretary of the Treasury Secretary. We've had regular visitors from the U.S. to Singapore as well, and Vice President Biden's office has just announced that he will be visiting Singapore at the end of July. So these are a very important part of our relationship, that we have this constant communication, that we can speak to each other with a matter of trust, with a matter of friendship, and opening up each other in terms of how we can work much closer together in this cooperation. Now, this sort of hard type of bilateral cooperation in economic, security, and diplomatic is supplemented by a very, very strong cooperation in new areas. Education and research and development has become a very new area. As I mentioned, Singapore's education system is one of the best in the world, particularly to K and 12. We have a memorandum of understanding with your Department of Education, and teachers now go back and forth, learning about different ways of teaching students, particularly at K to 12 level. We have several thousand scholarship students studying in U.S. universities, taking advantage of the fact that you have some of the best universities in the world, and how can we work closer together in that? We have researchers working with your research institutes in looking at new areas of cooperation. So that's a really new part of the relationship. And obviously the people-to-people ties are growing. As ambassador to the United States, I keep close contact with all the Singapore community in the United States. We have more than 25,000 people. Now, for a small country, this is very important because most of them are actually very highly qualified. Most of them are on the East Coast in New York in the financial community, or the West Coast in California in the IT industry. But now I see them across the country. I was in Austin and I met some Singaporeans over there. They're in Chicago. They're across the country, all over the place. And this is very important in terms of our cooperation. Now, I mentioned the Singapore-U.S. relationship in the bilateral context as we deal with each other, but there's also a very strong regional context to what we do. In many ways, the Singapore and the United States have very convergent strategic interests in the Asia-Pacific. We feel that the U.S. is an Asia-Pacific power, they are a resident power in the Asia-Pacific, and they have a legitimate role to play in the Asia-Pacific. And we have always welcomed a continuing U.S. presence in the region. And that's been very helpful for the U.S. in terms of dealing not just with us, but countries around the region. Because this sustained development has been where the U.S. has really shaped so much of the thinking and the architecture in the Asia-Pacific region. So under the Obama administration, there's been this very strong push, this pivot into Asia. And I know you've had people come here and speak to you on this pivot towards Asia. Now, that pivot towards Asia is it's a critical time because Asia is rising. Because you have a very dynamic Asia-Pacific region, and the U.S. plays a critical role in developing the frameworks for cooperation in the region. There's a meeting coming up this weekend in Southeast Asia, in Brunei, and Secretary Kerry will be there, my foreign minister will be there. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations work together with the U.S. in order to develop where we see the economic and political role of the U.S. in the region. President Obama has now committed to attend every year the annual East Asia Summit, which rotates among the Southeast Asian countries, and he will come out in October to attend the East Asia Summit in Brunei. He will also attend the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Indonesia a week before that. So it's a constant process of engaging much broader, and something that Singapore really welcomes. We have helped to shape some of this thinking of where the U.S. can play a role, but we're also working in new areas of cooperation. I mentioned how the economic ties are so important, and one very important thing which I think will have some impact on Alaska is the Trans-Pacific Partnership that Singapore, the United States, and 10 other countries are negotiating. I discussed this briefly with the governor yesterday, and he was interested to see how Alaska can, because you are a Pacific state, you fit into that Pacific geography of the United States. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a free trade agreement of 12 countries, including the United States and Japan, the first and third largest economies in the world, countries in Southeast Asia, Singapore, Malaysia, Brunei, and Vietnam, countries in the Pacific, Australia, and New Zealand, and countries in North America, Canada, and Mexico, and two in South America, Chile and Peru, coming together to build a framework where we look into the future of trade relationships. It's no longer just the movement of goods, and it's really movement of services. It's really dealing with global supply chains. And I think that Alaska, particularly with a very strategic role in the Asia Pacific, can play a very important role over there. It's going to fit into where we see the global free trade negotiations. What we're trying to achieve in the region is almost a single economic entity in terms of trade and economic relations. The other area where the U.S. has been working very closely with Singapore, as they've done this pivot into Asia, is an Enhanced Economic Engagement Initiative. This is the U.S. reaching out to the region to help the region develop further. And we're working with them to flesh this up so that there'll be common standards, common investment standards, harmonization of ideas that can work together. We've also created a program which is of interest across the region in third country training, where U.S. and Singapore trainers will work together to train the other countries in the region, areas as port management, airport management, water resource. And these are new areas of cooperation that we have with the U.S. The newest area of cooperation where they have the U.S. is in the Arctic. Last month at the Arctic Council meeting in Kiruna, Singapore was accepted as a permanent observer of the Arctic Council. The Arctic Council is made up of 8 states, including the United States. But the U.S. really plays a leadership role in it. And the U.S. is going to take on chair of the Arctic Council very soon. And many people ask why a tropical equatorial country like Singapore is interested in becoming part of this becoming an observer of the Arctic Council. We have obviously no interest in terms of trying to extract the oil and gas industry here. We have no major oil and gas companies of our own, but we can work with your companies in many things. But one of the main driving forces for Singapore to come into the Arctic Council, aside from our broader relationship with the U.S., has been in terms of dealing with the common threat of climate change. As a small, low-lying country at the equator, we are very much impacted by the implications of climate change. A 1 meter rise of water in Singapore would have 40% of Singapore underwater already. We have practically no space to move up. So we're very interested in knowing the implications of climate change as they develop. And part of that has also been our interest in terms of preserving Arctic flora and fauna, and in terms of looking at migratory bird partnerships as they fly from the Arctic all the way down to Singapore. And we have actually traced these routes, and many of them between the North and South Pole fly through Singapore. So we're starting to look at these implications in terms of wildlife, in terms of climate change, and how these things could fit in what is going on in Singapore. We've also been working in terms of protection of the Arctic marine environment. Because we have an expertise, I mentioned that Singapore has been a maritime trading center. We have an expertise as a maritime trading hub. Many of the things that we do in the Straits of Malacca, dealing with oil spill, dealing with prevention of environmental threats, really have some relevance to the Arctic. As the North Sea route opens up, we think that we can bring some expertise in port management, in logistics, and in areas like oil spill management from our region in Southeast Asia, bringing it up here to the Arctic area. And in terms of building the ports and the economic lifelines, that's very critical to what we can do. I mentioned technology. We have a company, Keppel Fels, which is actually refurbishing the Shell rig Kulak in Singapore, because they have developed the skills to develop oil rigs. They're building green oil rigs. They're also building icebreakers. So there are areas that we can work with that deal around climate change, that deal around marine resources, that deal around protection of marine areas, as well as new technology that can emerge. And we're starting to see where we can build up knowledge about the Arctic in Southeast Asia. Another thing I spoke to the governor about was how we can build a partnership where Singapore can become a place where Alaska and the Arctic countries can put a message across outside to a much bigger audience about what are the potential areas of cooperation with the rest of the world and Alaska. We are having centers that are going to build up expertise on Arctic international governance, emergence of new Arctic shipping lanes, and that's another area where we think we can work with you. The final area I want to speak about is really working with indigenous communities, because Singapore is a multi-ethnic state, and we have a range of communities that have started to build up and their own skills. We have invited, they are in the Arctic Council, they are a group of permanent participants that represent indigenous communities. We've invited them to Singapore, and they've looked and saw that there are many areas where they can cooperate with and learn from Singapore. And we see this as part of our own contribution in terms of where the opportunities can lie with the Arctic. So it's really in this context that we have, as we build our relationship with the United States, we see that relationship with the Arctic becoming much more important. And it's one of the reasons for my visit here, my first visit here, has been to get a sense of where the opportunities may lie. It will take time. I wouldn't want to give the impression it's going to happen overnight. But as we build up the skills and knowledge, I think working here, speaking with you, addressing the World Affairs Council over here, really is one of those steps that we are taking in order to reach out to the Arctic and Alaska. Thank you very much.
Ambassador, I'm going to invite you back to the podium in just a second to take questions, but first we're going to do a little quick housekeeping. The first thing is, Ambassador Mupuri and Mrs. Mupuri, thank you for coming to visit here in Alaska, and we have a small gift for you to take back to Singapore with you, and hopefully you'll remember us in fond light.
Thank you.
Welcome. And then, of course, for all of you who are not members of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and those of you who are on the fence about renewing your membership, please take some time. The membership cards are on your table. We are membership supported. We can't do the kinds of programs we brought to you today without your support. So please join the organization and give us your financial backing. And with that, we're going to ask you in the audience, if you do have a question, to wait for the microphone to get to you. I think Renee's got the microphone there, so raise your hand, she'll see you, and then the ambassador can answer the question, because again, we're recording this for future rebroadcasts. So with that, Ambassador, please come back to the microphone.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. I want to thank you for a very informative discussion, and you've talked a great deal about the partnership, really, that Singapore has with the United States and its ongoing in the Trans-Pacific Partnership in terms of ASEAN and all the rest of that. I would like to ask you a little bit, however, about Singapore's relationship with China and how that has evolved over the last couple of decades.
Okay. Well, China is the biggest country in Asia. And every country in Asia, you know about Singapore's size already, every country in Asia has to build a relationship with China. And Singapore's been doing this over many years. Firstly, we have a population that is 70% of Chinese origin. Many of them came to Singapore in the last 150 years, as to come and work in the British economy in Singapore at that time. So 70% of our population are Chinese, 14% are Malay origin from Indonesia and Malaysia, 8% are Indian origin from South Asia Indian, not American Indian, and both my wife and I are sort of South Asian Indian origin, and then there's the rest of really a mix of people that come in there. So when you already have a population that is Chinese, you have certain sort of advantages in working with them, we think. And where they really saw Singapore as a model that they could develop their economy with as they were starting to open the economy. Deng Xiaoping came to Singapore and saw that this was a model that he could work with in terms of moving China forward. We have done a number of projects in that time in our small way. Again, China is a country of 1.3 billion people. We are 5 million people. So we're quite realistic of how we can deal with these things. But we have worked with them to build up industrial parks, which then become model industrial parks for other provinces to come and learn from. We have done one in Suzhou, just outside Shanghai. We have worked with them to build up eco-cities. As they move into urbanization, how can they develop an environmentally friendly city? Because we are a city-state. And all we could deal with was our, within that restricted geography, how do we have the best sustainable environment for our people? And they started looking at that. And new areas of cooperation, social management, how do you deal with growing needs of society as an aging population? Singapore is an aging population. China is starting to have an aging population. How do you deal with many of these things? But China is also the largest economic partner for all the countries in Asia Pacific now. As they have grown, they have become so critical in everybody's thing, as they are a very important economic partner for the United States. U.S.-China trade is about $500 billion a year, which is huge. With Singapore, we have a bilateral trading agreement with them. We have regional trading agreements with them. So we see that China plays a very positive role in terms of the relationship with Southeast Asia. And as they develop further and further, I think there'll be more opportunities for us to cooperate together.
Yes, Ambassador, early in your remarks you said that you had, your country had at first concentrated on exports and that now you were getting into services, and I wondered if you could say specifically what sorts of services.
We still have manufacturing as a very important component of our economy. It used to be a very large component of the economy, these exports. We've moved them up where we started doing the basic things that developing countries do of putting genes together. We've really moved up to very, very high-tech industrial manufacturing. These are still being exported. Wafer fabs for your chips, your iPhone chips, are all being manufactured out of Singapore. And that is sort of one very important component of our economy, is about 25% focused on manufacturing. And many of the companies that come in still want to do that. The services sectors that we focused on are really financial services, consultancy services. We've developed as one of the major financial centers of the world. You know, in parallel with New York and London and Frankfurt and Tokyo, Singapore is one of those key financial centers. And that's been one major service that reaches out to the whole region. We're fortunate to be in a region that works very closely with Singapore. That, you know, there are much larger countries around our region. I was ambassador to Indonesia before coming here. Indonesia is a population of 250 million people. Now, their ability to do some of these things is obviously much slower. They are moving in the right direction, but it will take them much longer to move in the direction of being able to perform these services. So they turn to Singapore as a potential source of these services, financial services, consultancy services, similar with other countries in the region. Vietnam, which is just developing its economy, Thailand. So we've become the regional hub for many of these service industries. And that's where I think we will be even doing more into the future, particularly as we get a population that's more educated very quickly, they'll fit very well into our service economy.
Ambassador, thank you. You touched on prospective cooperation and between the U.S. and Singapore, but could you bring it down to Alaska? And you were mentioning that Singapore is moving away from manufacturing to more high-tech and financial services. Do you see ways that Alaska and Singapore can cooperate on perhaps financial services as well as export of commodities or high-tech and so forth?
I think it's early days yet, but I think there are opportunities to do it. Again, because of the differences in geography and climates, it's something very, very new for us. Financial services would fit in. Again, our companies make their own commercial choices of where they want to invest. And if there are investment opportunities here, and some of the people I've met here have presented potential investment opportunities, which I then pass on to the relevant people in Singapore to look at and to consider, that will take time because it's a completely new market for them. In terms of how do you invest away. In many ways, it's easier to invest in the region. But as they diversify, I think financial services will become critical. Alaska is the key for oil and gas. And I think that's where some of the new potential of cooperation can emerge. Singapore is the regional oil and gas center in Southeast Asia. We are surrounded by a region that is rich in hydrocarbons. We have no hydrocarbons of our own, but a country like Indonesia, Malaysia, the Gulf of Thailand, Australia, all have energy resources, and many of these things work out of Singapore. Many of the service companies that do these activities, many, the oil majors are all in Singapore, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, Chevron, Shell are all in Singapore. We also have many of the service companies, FMC, Halliburton, all out of Singapore. So where we have some of those skills, some of our shipbuilding skills, Keppel I mentioned, how can they work with these companies as they go into a very different environment of the Arctic? As I understand the Arctic more, it's a very different operating environment because how much harsher it is in terms of trying to get at the energy resources over here. A harsh environment and also very strict environmental rules, which I think are very critical to maintain in a very sensitive, biodiverse climate as this is, as we're dealing with issues of climate change. So it's new technologies that I think our companies can start considering whether they can have the skills to do these things as they support the energy companies doing out. The one major energy piece will be quite significant will be if Alaska starts exporting LNG. Singapore is an FTA country with the US is potentially a buyer for this LNG, as we could buy from anywhere in the world. But you know, that is one area where I think that people could, once Alaska decides how you want to manage your gas resources. So these are some of the early phases of that cooperation. The other areas are really around, as I mentioned, maritime cooperation. We are a very long-standing member of the International Maritime Organization. We have defined codes around oil spills in the Malacca Straits. The Malacca Straits is a very narrow straits of water where most of the world's oil passes through because of its way to the Far East. There have been accidents. We have the response capability to deal with that. We think that we can sort of bring some of that expertise as you sort of deal with some of those challenges here in Alaska. So as some of those will emerge, how can we work with that? Again, the technology is very different. It may not be relevant, but we think we can work with that, particularly with the IMO. We are working in terms of looking at the Polar Code. How do we deal with many of these areas? So I think there are areas for potential cooperation, but it's really early days as we sort of start considering in many ways what is a new frontier for us.
Ambassador, thanks a lot. I have a question. How do you see that the dynamics of the region, relationships with China in the region changing with the process of advancement of Trans-Pacific Partnership? ASEAN has the free trade agreement with China, right? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. You know, there is a regional organization which not all of you may be familiar with called ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Countries. This was started in 1967 with five countries initially, Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, and Thailand, which, as I mentioned, were the non-communist countries at that time when the Cold War was still on. Subsequently, in 1984, Brunei joined us, and then we had Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and Myanmar come in. So there are 10 countries in Southeast Asia. Very diverse countries economically, very diverse countries politically. But we've decided to come together as a group because of the dynamic China that we're dealing with and a very dynamic India that we're dealing with. We feel that our strength is going to come not as individual countries that vary in populations from 300,000 in Brunei to 250 million in Indonesia, from very urbanized countries like Singapore to landlocked countries like Laos. Where does the strength come from is really working together. We're very fortunate to be in this region with China and India on both sides. Now think of these as two economic dynamos. Either ASEAN is going to be lost as these two countries, each individual country is going to be lost as these two economic dynamos power ahead, or if we come together as a grouping, we can take advantage of that. That investors want to look for alternatives. Together as a grouping of 10 countries, we've got 600 million people. In China has got 1.3 billion, India's got 1.1 billion. We're not that far behind. We also have a growing middle class. You know, that's really the key for the American companies, because a large middle class that can compete what's available in China and India. We have an educated population. What we're trying to do in the region is an ASEAN economic community to take advantage of the dynamism of China and India. And that's where we see the positive part of dealing with it. It's not always smooth, you know, because you do have major issues in large countries with very large rural populations dealing with around issues of rural electrification and areas like this, which are very slow process of moving. And that's where the U.S. has become a very important partner for us. Because as the administration has pivoted to Asia, they've started discussing where they can do more things with the region as a whole. They've given us the credibility to work around as a region. And many of the things they do really focus on new innovation and ideas. Say in energy, they're starting to look at areas like smart grids that connect the whole region. And it helps to do many things for us together. And so as China and India rise, I think that rising tide will raise all boats. And that's really the sense we feel in terms of the benefits in the region.
Mr. Ambassador, could you comment on Singapore's policy and attitude towards, for lack of a better term, China's expansionist policies in South China Sea, and also looking ahead, what you see is going to happen there and the U.S.'s potential role in that conflict or policy?
There are territorial disputes in the South China Sea which involve China and four ASEAN countries, Malaysia, Brunei, Philippines, and Vietnam. Singapore is not a claimant state in these territorial disputes. And these territorial disputes really have to be resolved bilaterally between these countries. That's one thing that I think has to be remembered, that, you know, not every ASEAN country is there. But ASEAN has an interest because we feel that we don't want any disputes to upset our focus on economic development. And for a country like Singapore, which is a maritime trading state, the key really is that we want to have freedom of navigation. Even as these countries take their time to resolve territorial disputes, and territorial disputes take a long time to resolve, even between the U.S. and Canada at your border, in the north at Alaska, you have disputes about where the EEZ is going into. And these are two very close, friendly countries. So in the region, trying to deal with these territorial disputes, we have no anticipation that these will be resolved in the short term. So as they manage these disputes, we feel that freedom of navigation is very important to maintain, because without freedom of navigation, Singapore will not be a successful trading country. We feel that as they resolve these disputes, they should do it peacefully and using international law, including the UN Convention on Law of the Sea. So these are the key principles that we want to bring into the discussion. And in many ways, that fits the U.S. thinking as well. The U.S. values freedom of navigation. The U.S. values having the dispute resolution peacefully. What the region is trying to do as a whole, even though not all of us are claimant states with China and the South China Sea, is is to work out a framework where there is a less risk of misunderstanding. Our big concern is that in these waters, there could be an accident, there could be a fishing captain who encounters a Navy captain, and suddenly there is a blowout of, and these can then escalate the situation. So our approach now is to create what we call a code of conduct in that South China Sea. It's an ongoing discussion with China and the ASEAN countries to start formalizing this process. It's not going to resolve all the problems, but once we start talking, we think that at least you can have some sort of framework that people can deal with the potential risk of a fishing fleet going across borders, of a naval accident or an aircraft accident. How do you deal with these areas around that? So that's to create the right climate in terms of dealing with the disputes over there. Again, I wouldn't say that this can be overcome very quickly. It's taken us, we've been discussing many of these things for over 20 years, since the early 1990s, when there was a recognition how important the South China Sea is for all of these countries. And we haven't moved very far. But, territorial disputes take a very long time. Singapore and Malaysia, two very close countries, we had a territorial dispute over a piece of rock, which is about the size of a block here. It took us 30 years to get through that dispute. And so, I wouldn't want to underestimate in terms of the size of the area in the South China Sea. The U.S. role is important because the U.S. shares the interests of freedom of navigation. They share the interests of keeping the regional peace. And the U.S. is there in the position to sort of guide along and set up the rules of the game for the region as we operate. And that's why we welcome having the U.S. role. Also active in this are countries like Australia and others that, really don't have a stake there, but can play a role in discussing some of these things across the region.
Yes, during the days of Lee Kuan Yew, I remember that Singapore, at least Lee Kuan Yew, seemed to work as something of a mediator between the United States and China. And I was pretty impressed with that. I was just kind of curious if you feel that Singapore is more on one side or another now, more polarized, or can you act as a little bit of a mediator with these disagreements with China, or have the disagreements gone beyond the place where Singapore could play any part at all in this?
Lee Kuan Yew was the first Prime Minister of Singapore, and he stepped down in 1991. In many ways, he's seen as a global statesman, and he's got many friends in the United States and in China. I remember when I met Henry Kissinger and George Shultz, they told me of their relationship that Lee Kuan Yew, that goes back to the 1960s and 1970s. Deng Xiaoping had a relationship with Singapore that went back to the 1970s. So he was personally interested in discussing many of these things. Today, he's no longer in office, and he's celebrating his 90th birthday this year. But I think that Singapore, we have to be realistic in terms of where we can play a role. The US and China are the world's first and second largest economies. It's working your own relationships through, which are very critical in terms of how you can do that. It's for a small country, we have to walk a very fine line of not picking one side or the other. We believe that the regional Asia Pacific is going to be a peaceful region if the US and China can work out a good cooperative relationship. If that cooperative relationship is working, then throughout the region, we will all benefit from that. So we encourage both sides to speak to each other, to encourage with each other. We help sometimes to interpret messages, but you have enough experts in the United States on China, as China has experts on the United States, that we're sort of fairly modest in terms of our appreciation of that. And we were careful where we can play a role, where we are asked to step up and say a number of things, we try to do that. But it's really managing that relationship quite carefully, and for all the countries in the region, not just Singapore, to make sure that we're not picking sides. We don't want to have to pick a side. We really want to have a good, beneficial relationship between the U.S. and China, because that creates a very positive environment in the region.
Ambassador, thank you for coming. Earlier, you spoke that your interest in the Arctic Council was specifically because of the role of climate change and the devastating effects that it could have on your country. Could you please speak at all, what plans or strategies or what role does Singapore look for itself in the role of helping to shape the future of our climate?
We're a very small country. And again, we are realistic. Even if we had the best management of the environment in Singapore, it makes minuscule difference in what's happening in the rest of the world. It's the larger economies that set the framework. It's the leadership of large economies like India, China, and the United States that will set that framework for global climate change issues. But in that context, Singapore thinks we can play a role sometimes to put across the perspective of smaller countries. We're an island state. We feel the challenges of other island states as the rising sea levels are coming up. We've built up the technology to deal with some of these things. We work around the world looking at some of these technologies to prepare ourselves as well as to share some of that knowledge across. We have a very active climate change process domestically to make sure that we can start preparing ourselves better in this way. But again, I must be careful to underline it's very modest what we can do. So what we do, for example, in the United States is we work on a project of green buildings where we retrofit buildings to make them more environmentally friendly, a building like this, for example. And working with the U.S., we are now able to share some of that with other countries in the region. It's one way that we feel it can be useful to be able to do that. So where we feel we can be useful, we try and bring some of these. While we're dealing with our own concerns, we have a region that is also very badly impacted by climate change. We are seeing all the implications of different weather patterns as they impact us. We have got forest fires in the neighborhood that also partly caused by climate changes. And these are things that we're quite alert to, and how can we deal with that? But again, we're quite modest in what we can do, but where we can be helpful, and particularly in technology, we want to be able to play that role.
Okay. Well, Ambassador Mumpuri, thank you again for coming to Anchorage, Alaska, and speaking with us. And so with that, we're going to call our meeting to an end and to remind you to watch your emails for our next upcoming programs. And again, thank you for all for joining us today.
Thank you again. It was really great.
Thank you. Thank you for
your perspective. It's just insightful.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.